Our second speaker this morning is our brother Nathan Lewis of the Christ Church North New Zealand Ecclesia. The theme for Brother Nathan's classes is Jehu, Driving Furiously for God. Today's class is entitled The Baskets, The Heaps of Heads, based on 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 1 through 14. And we'll call on Brother Nathan to deliver that class for us.
All right, well, we left Jehu eating and drinking inside while the dogs ate outside. And the queen that had ruled the northern 10 tribes with an iron fist for 33 years lay abandoned, unattended to, unwanted in the street like a common criminal. And you can imagine, brothers and sisters, how the people would have felt. The years of tyranny and persecution and darkness that had descended on the northern kingdom was gone in a moment at the death of Jezebel. And you know, with that, you could say maybe that's the end of Jehu's work. I mean, both kings lay dead in the dust, and Jezebel's inedible body parts are strewn in the streets outside, the fields outside Jezreel. And you might even perhaps forgive Jehu for calling it a day. I mean, he's kind of killed the main males of Ahab's house, and Jezebel is dead. But Jehu was a man who drove furiously. He was focused, and he had plenty of unfinished business. But it was going to be different now, wasn't it? The element of surprise was gone. And now he needed to do things a little differently. His intentions were out in the open. Now he needed strategy, some cunning, a bit of a plan. And it's a bit like, I think, a parable of elimination of sin in our lives. There are some big obvious things that we need to cut out. The Jehorams, the Ahaziahs, the Jezebels. And then there are the smaller things, the niggly sins, the 42 sons that we've got to still take care of, the character defects that are smaller but keep plaguing us. Oh, on Sunday morning we come and we are good, sitting in the memorial meeting. Eliminating sin and evil seems easy. But come Monday morning, Tuesday morning, back in the world, it's always more difficult and we need a plan. And now Jehu is going to recalibrate and refocus to complete the job in 2 Kings chapter 10. He doesn't have an army. The army's on the other side of the Jordan. He's just got a handful of loyal followers, and he's going to move quickly. And we read in chapter 10, verse 1, these words. And Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, and Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to them that brought up Ahab's children. Now, if you look at our family tree, all right, this is where we are. And what's going to happen in the next few verses is Jehu is going to tackle these 70 sons here, the other sons of Ahab, now that Joram is dead. Okay, the rest of the immediate line of Ahab are tackled next. 70 sons. That's interesting, isn't it? We saw in our class on Adonai Bezek that the number 70 refers to what? The Gentiles. See what we're being told? This family never really came into the truth, did they? They're basically Gentiles. Now, officially, in case you were wondering, Rehoboam holds the record for the most number of children in the scriptures. 28 sons and 60 daughters. That makes a total of 88 children. But I would suggest to you that Ahab clearly has 70 sons plus these two, and there's no mention of any daughters. And any of us who have seen large families, typically there's both. So I'm going to suggest maybe Ahab, his family was substantially larger again than Rehoboam. Do you think there's any chance this king might have been worshipping Baal, do you think, brothers and sisters? The god of fertility? His family's like rabbits. They're everywhere. Dozens and dozens of them. No wonder they have foster parents, as we read in verse 1. That's how it literally is, foster parents. It's a big job being in the fertility business and lots of kids. But do you know, this is the world. The most important job of all, preparing a godly seed, is, well, it's delegated to other people because Ahab and Jezebel couldn't really care less about the most important thing in life, raising a godly seed. And so these 70 sons are going to be looked after by these foster parents in verse 1, those that brought up Ahab's children. And we're going to see they're more like hirelings than shepherds. They care more about their own hides than the flocks. Remember what John 10 verse 13 says? When the wolf comes, the hireling flees. They were prepared to sacrifice the 70 sons to save their own lives. But for now, the big question facing Jehu was, how do I get every last one of the sons of Ahab as Elijah and Elisha had commanded? I mean, it was a bit like an impossible mission, wasn't it? They were everywhere. Ironically, it was the same kind of task that was faced by Athaliah, who later on was going to try and eliminate all of the sons down here so that she could be the sole ruler of the tribe of, or the kingdom of Judah. Can't just forget one. You've got to get every last one. And now Jehu has got to make sure he gets every last one of Ahab's sons and destroys them. How's he going to do it? And then Jehu hits on a solution, brothers and sisters, that was as ironic as it was elegant. He wrote letters. Remember we said in the last couple of classes that this story is full of moments of irony and poetic justice. What's this an echo of? And the answer is 1 Kings 21, verses 8 to 11. Jezebel wrote letters. And who did she write the letters to? Why, the elders in Jezreel. And what did those letters say? Well, it was to organize the secret death of Naboth. And now Jehu is going to wreak vengeance on Ahab's house using his wife's methods, letters to the same elders. And do you know, the word letters is going to occur four times in 1 Kings 21 and four times here in 2 Kings chapter 10. She wrote letters in Ahab's name, verse 8, and sent the letters unto the elders, verse 8. She wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast, verse 9, and as it was written in the letters, verse 11. And when we come to 2 Kings 10, Jehu wrote letters. As soon as the letter cometh unto you, he wrote a letter the second time, and when the letter came to them, verse 7, four times in each of these chapters, letters were written. And both sets of letters were written to the same elders in Samaria and in Jezreel. This is poetic indeed, is it not, brothers and sisters? This is like a tribute to Naboth and the justice of God. I love this story. God doesn't forget, brothers and sisters. He doesn't. It's all in hand and justice will be done. And the letters said this, verse 2, as soon as this letter cometh unto you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there are with you chariots and horses, a fenced city also in armor, look even out the best and meetest of your master's sons, and set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. Find the best and meetest. Literally, it's the goodliest and the fittest, the best fighting man of the 70. Set them on the throne, says Jehu. And I think it's another subtle allusion back to Naboth. Remember Jezebel had said in 1 Kings 21 verse 9, set him on high. And Jehu's going to say, find the best of Ahab's sons and set him on high. Fight for your throne. But just remember, says Jehu, that Naboth couldn't stand before two false witnesses. And maybe verse 4, your sons won't be able to stand either now that two kings are dead. Where are your loyalties? See, he's putting them between a rock and a hard place. He knows what they'll do, but the pressure is now on. Now, maybe it was just a bluff. If Jehu had shown up, they might have laughed at his pitiful excuse of an army. But he was a military captain, and he knew, didn't he, the value of intimidation and fear. And timing. Now, as soon as this letter cometh to you, see the point? It's urgent. There was no time to rally troops. This was a one-off offer for them to pit the royal princes against himself. A winner-takes-all battle. Right here, right now. He knew their cowardly, spineless natures. There was no way that they were going to fight. And we read in verse 4, but they were exceedingly afraid and said, behold, two kings stood not before him. How then shall we stand? And he that was over the house, and he that was over the city, the elders also, and the bringers up of the children sent to Jehu, saying, we are thy servants, and will do all that thou shalt bid us. We will not make any king do that which is good in thine eyes. Utter capitulation and submission. King Sin is ultimately a coward. When faced with serious opposition, it will always seek self-preservation at any cost. And so now, Jehu puts his proposition, and it's a psychological masterpiece. Verse 6, then he wrote a letter the second time to them, saying, if ye be mine, and if ye will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men your master's sons, and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time. Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. Now I'm hoping that now your eyes are opened as to the poetic justice in this story. You would have seen in verse 6 an immediate echo of poetic justice. By tomorrow this time, 24 hours, a threat of death. It is exactly the expression that Jezebel used in her letter to Elijah. 1 Kings 19, verse 2. So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of the prophets of Baal, by tomorrow about this time. This was Jezebel's threat, now being revisited by Jehu upon her own children's heads. See how wonderful this story is? How God works? And now there was immense time pressure. It's about 25 kilometers from Jezreel to Samaria, let's say 17 or 18 miles. And there's no instant communication. You can't send a telegram or a text message. There's not actually time in 24 hours really to send a message, go, come back, accumulate information and decide what to do. They needed to decide instantly. And Jehu was saying, I need an answer by tomorrow. It's what you might call a true deadline. Now, look how this expression is used through the scriptures. Because this expression, tomorrow about this time, is going to be used a few times. Exodus 9, verse 18. Behold, tomorrow about this time, I will cause it to rain a very grievous hail. Or Joshua 11, Yahweh said unto Joshua, be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up. 1 Samuel 9, tomorrow about this time I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin. Thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people Israel. 1 Samuel 11, Saul, they said unto the messengers that came, tomorrow by that time that the sun be hot, ye shall have help. And lastly, one a little closer to the time of Jezebel, 2 Kings 7, verse 1. Then Elisha said, "Hear the word of Yahweh. Tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria." God, brothers and sisters, can completely change the landscape in just one day. That's what we're being told. Everything can change in 24 hours when God gets involved. And see that last reference? Tomorrow about this time, it was happening in the gate of Samaria. How ironic. The elders of Samaria had heard this phrase before. Tomorrow about this time. And the last time they heard it, brothers and sisters, someone died. The Lord of the king who disbelieved. Tomorrow about this time. He lost his life. And so the lesson is that our lives can completely change in 24 hours when God gets involved. We need to remember this. God's in control and he can work quickly. We've got to have faith that our lives are held in the hollow of his hand. And one day soon, brothers and sisters, in 24 hours, our lives are going to be completely changed. By tomorrow, about this time, it's going to happen. These judgments are coming. The greater than Jehu is on his way. And so faced with the pressure and the manipulation of Jehu's 24-hour deadline, well, they gave in. Verse 7. It came to pass when the letter came to them that they took the king's sons and they slew 70 persons and put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jezreel. This is King Sin, prepared to sacrifice his own children to save his own hide. Do you know, it's worse, isn't it, when you think about it? It's worse than offering your children to Molech. Because at least if you offer your children to Molech, you're doing it in the belief that it's a gift to your gods. These people aren't doing it for that. It's just about keeping themselves alive. It's murdering your own children. And did you hear the faint echo of poetic justice? Ahab, you'll remember, he wanted to take Naboth's vineyard. Naboth's ability to produce baskets and baskets of grapes and turn it into a garden of herbs. And now the elders are going to substitute their lives with the baskets of Ahab's sons' heads. I think there's maybe faint overtones back to Naboth here again. God is bringing Ahab's decisions back on his family's heads. And so we read in verse 8, "And there came a messenger and told him, saying, 'They have brought the heads of the king's sons.' And he said, 'Lay them in 2 heaps at the entering in of the gate until the morning.'" There came a messenger. Do you know, that's exactly the same as 1 Kings 21 and verse 14, where they sent a messenger to Jezebel to say, "Naboth is stoned and is dead." There's a messenger now that's sent. There's irony, isn't there, in every verse here, brothers and sisters. It's the repeat of Naboth in reverse. Now, I couldn't help reading this verse and wondering what these 2 heaps of heads might signify. Now, I don't know, and I'd be very interested in your thoughts afterwards, because it's good to tease our minds about these things. But if we think about maybe how this could be a sacrifice, a type of the sacrifice of Christ, we've got 70 heads in 2 baskets. So if I think about it, I'm seeing 35 heads in 1 basket, or maybe on one side of the gate, and 35 heads in another basket on the other side of the gate. Reminds me of the promise to Abraham, possessing the gate of his enemies. I wonder whether cutting 70 in half is an allusion to the 70 weeks prophecy. You remember that it says Jesus Christ would be cut off in the midst of the week. The last week of the 70 weeks prophecy is divided into 3.5 days and 3.5 days. Here we've got 35 heads and 35 heads. Is there an allusion here? Maybe we think about the 7 animals that were sacrificed by Abraham in Genesis chapter 15, when he went into a deep sleep and God entered into a covenant with Abraham. 7 animals were divided in half, and God walked between the pieces. If you like, in symbol, 3.5 animals either side. I can see shadows, but maybe you can come up with some thoughts of your own and share them with me. Either way, whether there's a type here of the sacrifice of Christ, this was an unmistakable way of both verifying the head count, true, easier to count the heads, and simultaneously deterring the rest of the people from further rebellion. You stack the heads outside the gate, everyone else is saying, yeah, we'll think twice about rebelling against Jehu. The still warm and grisly blood-stained heads piled up gruesomely in the sun. 2 piles of slain sons right outside the gates of Jezreel. Does it remind us of anything? It's right where Naboth's sons lay buried themselves. And now Ahab's sons are going to be stacked up in baskets outside the gate of Jezreel. There is exquisite irony here to the finely tuned judgments of God. Sons for sons. In exactly the same place, in the portion of Naboth, just outside the gate of the city. And we read in verse 9, it came to pass in the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, ye be righteous, behold, I conspired against my master and slew him. But who slew all these? I think this is Jehu making sure that all the elders are firmly implicated in the conspiracy. You could read it as astonishment that he comes out and he's like, whoa, what's happened here? He's the one who asked them to do it. There's not really surprise. I think this is Jehu's clever manipulation of the elders into betraying their own to death out of fear. And he wants it on public record that now everybody, it seems, is supporting his kingship. There would be no self-righteousness or self-defense from his enemies now. They had completely and publicly implicated themselves in Jehu's conspiracy. Who killed these? Now they were involved. They couldn't get out. And the revolt, the insurrection, the nationwide coup was proceeding apace. And we read in verse 10, he says, know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of Yahweh, which Yahweh spake concerning the house of Ahab, for Yahweh hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. Do you know, this is the third time, isn't it, that Jehu mentions Elijah's words. He does it in chapter 9, verse 26, and of course he does it in chapter 9, verse 36, when he's sacrificing Jezebel. Here's a man who acknowledges Yahweh's providence. This was what Yahweh said would happen. I think there's a real spiritual dimension to this man. And in actual fact, his words in verse 10 are an allusion to the words of 1 Samuel chapter 3. Hold your hand in 1 Kings 10 and come back to 1 Samuel chapter 3, because there's a parallel here. Jehu is actually quoting the scriptures. 1 Samuel chapter 3 in verse 19. And Samuel grew, and Yahweh was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And Jehu was going to say, know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of Yahweh. He's quoting from 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 19. This is not just a one-dimensional killing machine. He knows his scriptures. This is according to the words of Elijah, according to the words of Elijah, according to the words of Elijah. He quotes from Samuel. He definitely has a spiritual dimension. It was like both Samuel and Jehu weren't going to let any of God's words or promises fall to the ground. They held them up. And just as Eli and Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and Eli's dynasty was evil, and Samuel would replace them, now Jehu would replace Joram and Ahaziah and Ahab's dynasty. And his attitude was the same as Samuel's. Yahweh is with me. He's with me. He won't let my his words and my work fall to the ground. He wasn't uneducated, was he? He wasn't just a hired bow and arrow. Jehu was quoting the scriptures publicly. None of my arrows are wasted, he's saying. None will fall needlessly to the ground. I am Yahweh's man and Yahweh is with me. And on the back of this confidence-building triumph where he'd done nothing, hadn't he? Jehu had done nothing and the elders had embroiled themselves inextricably in his revolution and done all the hard work themselves. Now we read in verse 11, "So Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men and his kinsfolks and his priests, until he left him none remaining." It's a clinical fulfillment of his mission. No distractions, no mistakes. Rotherham says, "There was not left remaining a survivor." And you know, this is a Bible theme. None remained. We know from these words in Exodus 14 that it's also a description of the destruction of sin in the form of Pharaoh's host. The waters returned, covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. All of it, or Deuteronomy chapter 3, "Yahweh our God delivered into our hands Og also, king of Bashan, and all his people, and we smote him until none was left to him remaining." Or 1 Samuel 11, "It came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together, not one remaining." It's the spirit of Joshua over and over and over again. Joshua 8, 10, 11, "He left none remaining." It's a phrase that captures the completeness of God's victory. There are no loose ends. Sin is not going to sneak out the back door and still survive somewhere. There is complete and utter destruction. And I wonder if Jehu isn't picking up the spirit of Joshua consciously. As Joshua destroyed the Canaanites, now he would destroy the infiltration of Canaanite and Tyrian idolatry into Yahweh's people. He would not rest until there was none remaining. Maybe he could see the parallels. Maybe he could feel like he was fulfilling the spirit of Joshua. And now the nobles and the priests that were involved in the innocent murder of Naboth in 1 Kings 21 and verse 8 are going to be rounded up, slaughtered. God has not forgotten. God has not forgotten. 12 years on, those elders are now rounded up and taken care of. And all of Ahab's household, nephews and princes, both in Jezreel, verse 11, and in Samaria, verse 17, are taken care of. So back to our family tree. What have we done? The 70 sons are killed, and now these sons in Jezreel and Samaria are also killed by Jehu, verse 11 and 17. He's making good progress. And so we come to the last few verses of our class this morning and the killing of the 42 princes. Now, where are the 42 princes? Well, they are down here. The 42 sons, who are the sons of Athaliah, daughter of Ahab. We're now four generations down, and there are 42 sons. Now, you can see from the slide that actually Ahaziah's older brothers have already been killed by the Arabians, we're told, in 2 Chronicles 22, verse 1, and that happens before Ahaziah is killed himself. He only comes to the throne because these have been killed by the Arabians, and then Ahaziah is the second king, the king of Judah, that's killed by Jehu. So when we come across 42 sons, they must be these sons here, who are the sons of the eldest sons of Athaliah. Does that make sense? Hopefully it will by as we read. In fact, 2 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 8 says quite clearly they were the sons of the brethren of Ahaziah. So if we were in any doubt, 2 Chronicles 22 verse 8 says it very clearly. The 42 sons were the sons of the brethren of Ahaziah. They're probably teenagers, all right? Imagine like the 16 and 17 and 18 year olds we have in the room next door. They were like that. They can't have been too much older because they're four generations from Jezebel. And it seems like they're traveling up from Jerusalem. Remember, they live in Judah in the south, and they have no idea about the chaos and the carnage of Jehu's revolution that's happening in the northern kingdom. They're coming up to visit Joram and Ahaziah, we're told. Let's read verses 12 to 14. And he arose, departed, and came to Samaria. And as he was at the shearing house in the way, Jehu met with the brethren of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, "Who are ye?" And they answered, "We are the brethren of Ahaziah. In fact, we're his nephews. And we go down to salute the children of the king and the children of the queen." They've got no idea. And he said, "Take them alive." And they took them alive and slew them at the pit of the shearing house, even 240 men. Neither left he any of them. So they're coming up to visit Joram and Ahaziah. They've got no idea that they've already been murdered in chapter 9. Now, there's no text messages or instant communications back in those days. These 42 teenagers are ignorant of what's happened. And so the last group of Ahab's male relatives, his remaining 42 grandsons, are going to fall right into Jehu's lap. Can you imagine it? You've just finished killing these sons. You walk around the corner and the last group of Ahab's sons walk up to you. This is God in the story, brothers and sisters. This is not Jehu doing his own thing and acting in a rogue way. God is delivering these men right into Jehu's lap. Do you know, Josephus says, they replied that they had come to salute Joram and their own king Ahaziah, for they knew not that he had slain them both. They're in ignorance. You can imagine, they're like, "We're off to see Joram and Ahaziah." Jehu would have been, "You've got no idea. Come in here. Come in here. Let me tell you." He'd moved quickly and they had not heard. And so it happens that Jehu doesn't even have to travel down into Judah to execute his judgments on that side of Ahab's descendants. They just show up in Samaria. Do you know, some people, as we said maybe in our last class, have suggested that this is Jehu dabbling in the southern kingdom. And I've heard it said that he should never have done this. He starts going beyond his brief. And this is going to precipitate a catastrophe in the southern kingdom, because into this vacuum, where there are no longer any sons, Athaliah is going to step in. It's going to basically bring about a vortex of bad things that are going to happen in the southern kingdom. And the point that's raised is maybe Jehu precipitated that by doing the wrong thing. And I don't agree. I don't think that's true. I think we established last time that actually he's commended for carrying out God's instructions to the letter. The female Athaliah was not as brief. She'll be ultimately taken care of by Jehoiada the priest. And do you know, I think here in the story, we have the divine answer. God's going to deliver the Judean part of Ahab's dynasty right into Jehu's hand. See what it says in the margin? It says, Jehu met with the brethren of Ahaziah, king of Judah. And in the margin it says, he found them. It's exactly the word of chapter 9, verse 21, when it says, he found them in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. This was God's arrangements and timing. These were the last few remaining male members of Ahab's dynasty, albeit from Judah by marriage, but they're not forgotten by Jehu. They have to come, well, they're coming up to see, it says in the margin, to seek the peace of Joram and Ahaziah. But there was never going to be any peace for this family, despite their desire for it at all costs. And Jehu says, kill them. Kill them. 42 men who should have been the future shepherds of the southern kingdom, but who were more like wolves in sheep's clothing. They're actually descendants of Ahab, who have infiltrated the southern kingdom. And here, they're delivered to the slaughterhouse. And actually, it turns out, Jehu was the shepherd and they were the sheep. And they were found to be blemished, covered in sores and lame. And instead of being shorn in the shearing house, they were sacrificed by the judge, found to be rotten and unacceptable. And the irony was, they were killed at a shearing house, the very place where coats and coverings were generated. But there would be no covering for these men. They were blemished and unforgiven, cursed by God. Now, it's interesting to look at the three references or instances where shearing has come about in the scripture up until now. You might remember them or be able to think of some of them, but here they are. The three times up until now where shearing has been mentioned in the Bible. Genesis 31, Laban went to shear his sheep. And look what we find. Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's. And Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he told him not that he fled. And the shearing house in the days of Laban and Rachel and Jacob was associated with Rachel's stolen images, idolatry, evil. How about Genesis 38? It was told Tamar, saying, behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnath to shear his sheep. And she put her widow's garments off from her, covered her with a veil, wrapped herself, sat in an open place, and immorality comes about at the time of shearing. Or Nabal, the story of Abigail, shearing his sheep in Carmel. And he's a fool, he's churlish and evil in his doings. Wherever we see shearing, it's always associated with evil. And here is the same. Almost as if to say, shearing the lamb is not enough to cover sin. It's not the principle of Genesis 3, is it? It's got to be Hebrews 9, verse 22. Without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. And Rachel and Judah and Nabal all thought maybe that they were safe, hiding themselves under a lamb's wool covering. But it wasn't enough. It was just a shorn coat of wool, not a sacrificed one. And maybe the lesson is that a lamb's fleece without sacrifice is an unacceptable disguise. And these royal sons should have been covered by a true coat of skins, a proper lambskin generated by a sacrifice and the shedding of blood. Without it, there was no forgiveness. And Jehu says, kill them. They're Ahab's house, uncovered and condemned by God. There would be no hiding here, no disguises that would rescue them from Jehu's sword. And in the pit, they're all dispatched. And so with these men, every last descendant of the house of Ahab has been killed, exactly as God has asked. And from this point, the Chronicles record in 2 Chronicles 22 on is going to switch from tracing Israel in the north to Judah in the south, as it abandons Jehu's reign and instead traces the survival of Messiah's line through the time of Athaliah and Joash, the northern kingdom had effectively been rescued by Jehu. His commission was complete. Every last one of Ahab's sons and Jezebel were gone. This was in every way Jehu, the judge, who had come. And as we finish this class, I want to just introduce to you the type of the story. We're going to develop it a little further, but here's what's happening behind the story of Jehu. Because Elijah, Elisha, and Jehu are going to form for us a big framework that's going to point forward to Jesus Christ. We know that Elijah was the brusque prophet from the wilderness who confronted the apostasy, marched into Ahab's palace. He, of course, is going to be a type of John the Baptist. And following him is Elisha. Yah is salvation. He does twice as many miracles as Elijah, a double portion of the Spirit, but he's more concerned with teaching and saving. There's no records of the sword of Elisha. This is, well, we'll see in a second who this is. And then we come to Jehu. He drives furiously. He brings God's unerring judgments and vengeance on the apostasy for their lack of repentance. And here in the story of Kings, we're going to have John the Baptist, the first advent of Christ, Elisha, and the second advent of Christ. So the work of Jehu, yes, it is a type of Christ, but it's pointing forward, not to the work that Elisha would do, teaching and healing and working miracles and saving people. No, this is the coming of Christ to bring vengeance and flaming fire on those that know not God. Does that make sense? So here, Jehu is still a type of Christ, but Christ in his second advent. And do you know, I find this story absolutely fascinating because, let me just make sure I'm not getting ahead of myself here. All right. Okay, because, well, did you hear an echo in chapter 10 when all of a sudden around the corner come 42 men? Did anyone hear an echo? It wasn't that long ago we had 42 men in the record of Kings, was it? Now, here's the thing. What we're going to find is that Elisha and Jehu are both representing Christ, but one's the first advent and one is the second. And what we're going to find in 2 of Kings is that everything that Elisha does in 2 of Kings chapters 2 to 8 is going to be replicated in 2 of Kings 9 and 10, because both of them are Christ. And the story is going to give us all these parallels so we don't miss the type. Both of these men are going to experience the same things because they're both representing Christ in the story. Look at this. Jehu, his story starts with the pouring out of oil by a son of the prophets behind shut doors. Does that remind us of anything? Well, it reminds us of the pouring out of oil by a son of the prophets behind shut doors. 2 of Kings chapter 4, verses 2 to 6. The Syrian captain, Naaman, was healed and converted, and now Israel's captain is going to be promoted. And maybe converted, we say, question mark, Jehu. Jehu was a man in a chariot driving furiously. And in chapter 4, we have a woman on an ass that slacked not her riding. See the parallel? How about this one? A eunuch in chapter 8, verse 6, is going to restore the Shunammite woman. In chapter 9, the eunuchs are going to kill a Zidonian woman. But it's the same watermark, eunuchs and women. Jezebel trampled underfoot in Jezreel. We know the parallel. The lord or the captain was trampled underfoot in Samaria in 2 of Kings chapter 7. Can't miss it, can we? Trampled underfoot both times. What about here? Jehu, the nourishers, were killing their own children. And in 2 Kings chapter 6, we've got mothers killing their own children. In 2 Kings 6, the king threatens to remove Elisha's head. In 2 Kings 10, Jehu takes off the heads of the king's sons. Here's the one that got me onto this. 42 young princes of Judah slain, 42 youths slain for cursing Elisha. Can't miss it, can we? The only time 42 occurs, right? There's a clear parallel. The princes are slain in a pit by a sheep shearing house in chapter 10. And Mesha, king of Moab, who was a sheep master who paid in wool, was killed in the ditches in chapter 3. Elisha brought life by putting mouth upon mouth, chapter 4. And we're going to find in our story tomorrow that Jehu was going to bring death to all those who were in the temple, who were crammed in so tight, it says in the margin, they were mouth to mouth. See what's happening? God is bringing these together in a fascinating way. The watermarks are all the same. Sitting in behind the story are all these parallels to tell us these two men, Elisha and Jehu, are really the same man. It's Jesus Christ. Different advents. But despite the similarities, which are unmistakable, they're going to enact two different advents. Elisha's going to come first, and then he's going to anoint Jehu and step back into the shadows. So Jehu is Christ, brothers and sisters, in this story, bringing God's judgments on an apostate, idolatrous world. He's not making mistakes. He's not overstepping his brief. He's not going too far. God is delivering these men into his hand. He doesn't even have to travel into Judah. We have to have absolute confidence, brothers and sisters, that God has the affairs of the world in hand. So what are our take-home lessons from this morning? Relentless determination. He didn't give up having slain Joram, Ahaziah, and Jezebel. Do we give up when we're 80% done, or do we push through? Do we let any of God's words fall to the ground? Are we enduring unto the end that we might be saved? Determined to fulfill our commission right to our last breath. Do you know Hebrews 6 says these beautiful words? We desire that every one of you do show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end. We've got to be determined, brothers and sisters, to see this through. And Jehu, who was a man who was driven furiously, he wasn't going to stop until he'd fulfilled God's mission. What about tackling the smaller sins? Do we stop at just removing the big evils in our lives, or do we have a strategy to uproot the smaller and less obvious character flaws, the little bad habits, the less glaring faults? Are we working on rooting out the whole house of Ahab, or just the kings and Jezebel? And lastly, I think this is an important lesson. Sin was confronted quickly. Jehu didn't hang around for a few months and come up with a plan. He acted decisively. Ecclesiastes 8 says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Jehu didn't procrastinate. He moved swiftly, so swiftly that the 42 men were caught completely unawares. And sometimes, brothers and sisters, we don't do that, do we? We allow sin to gather its forces, marshal its troops, amass its strongest defense against us, and then we wonder why it's so difficult to overcome. Let's learn from this lesson to tackle sins more quickly in our lives, and maybe we can be a little bit more like Jehu and like our Lord. He neither left any of them. Wonderful lessons in this story as we see a marvelous type of our Lord Jesus Christ tackling and defeating the power of sin. Let's take these lessons to heart, brothers and sisters, as we ponder the relentless drive of this determined chariot driver who drove furiously for God.